Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a reading and conversation presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program. Our speaker is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri. Moderating tonight's conversation is award-winning author Daphne Colote. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor Ha Jin from the Creative Writing Program.
Welcome, everyone, and this is a very special occasion. And Jhumpa is going to give a reading, and then Daphne Colote will interview her on stage. In fact, Jhumpa hardly need any introduction. She's an internationally renowned author, an author for two collections of short stories and two novels. And she also garnered numerous awards, such as the Pulitzer Prize, the Pan Henry Award for First Fiction, also the Frank O'Connor International Prize for Short Fiction. That is the biggest prize for the short fiction in the world. And her latest novel, and the novel she's going to read tonight, she's going to read from tonight, The Lowland, just came out and was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and also was a finalist for the National Book Award. But for me, this is really a very, very happy evening. It is really a reunion, because I've known Jhumpa for many years. We studied in the same class at the BU and shared kind of a similar struggle. I remember during our study with Leslie at BU, and also after graduation, for a long time, we have been struggling. We were struggling to get published. In fact, in some of our letters, we talk about where to send the stories and how to get them published. And I also remember in one of her letters, she included and enclosed a copy of her first published story, I think The Real Dewan, that was by published by a quarterly, I think, called The Story. But that small mag went out of business a long time ago in Ohio. But anyway, I'm trying to say for me, I really double rejoice in her success nowadays, because I shared a small portion of her beginning. And let's welcome Jhumpa.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for coming. I'm really so honored and happy to be here, and especially to be in this room tonight with Leslie, with Ha Jin, and with Daphne. It is an extremely happy reunion, the best of reunions, and I really do look forward to talking with Daphne in a little while about writing, which is what we always talk about anyway. Just not in front of lots of people, but I look forward to talking to her. But before we do that, I will read to you from The Lowland. From two different sections of the book, both toward the beginning. The first section is it starts on page 2, so there isn't very much to explain, only that the book takes this part of the book opens in in Calcutta, in India, and this is the late 1950s. So I'm going to read this part and then pause and then explain a little bit of what happens in between and then read a second part. They'd never set foot in the Tolly Club. Like most people in the vicinity, they'd passed by its wooden gate, its brick walls, hundreds of times. Until the mid-40s, from behind the wall, their father used to watch horses racing around the track. He'd watch from the street, standing among the bettors and other spectators unable to afford a ticket or to enter the club's grounds. But after the Second World War, around the time Subhash and Udayan were born, the height of the wall was raised so that the public could no longer see in. Bismillah, a neighbor, worked as a caddy at the club. He was a Muslim who had stayed on in Taliganj after partition. For a few paisa, he sold them golf balls that had been lost or abandoned on the course. Some were sliced like a gash in one skin, revealing a pink, rubbery interior. At first, they hit the dimpled balls back and forth with sticks. Then Bismillah also sold them a putting iron with a shaft that was slightly bent. A frustrated player had damaged it, striking it against a tree. Bismillah showed them how to lean forward, where to place their hands. Loosely determining the objective of the game, they dug holes in the dirt and tried to coax the balls in. Though a different iron was needed to drive the ball greater distances, they used the putter anyway. But golf wasn't like football or cricket, not a sport the brothers could satisfactorily improvise. In the dirt of the playing field, Bismillah scratched out a map of the Tolly Club. He told them that closer to the clubhouse, there was a swimming pool, stables, a tennis court, restaurants where tea was poured from silver pots, special rooms for billiards and bridge, gramophones playing music, bartenders in white coats who prepared drinks called Pink Lady and Gin Fizz. The club's management had recently put up more boundary walls to keep intruders away, but Bismillah said that there were still sections of wire fencing where one might enter along the western edge. They waited until close to dusk when the golfers headed off the course to avoid the mosquitoes and retreated to the clubhouse to drink their cocktails. They kept the plan to themselves, not mentioning it to other boys in the neighborhood. They walked to the mosque at their corner, its red and white minarets distinct from the surrounding buildings. They turned onto the main road, carrying the putting iron and two empty kerosene tins. They crossed to the other side of Technician Studio. They headed toward the paddy fields where the Adi Ganga once flowed, where the British had once sailed boats to the Delta. These days it was stagnant, lined with the settlements of Hindus who'd fled from Taka, from Rajshahi, from Chittagong, a displaced population that Calcutta accommodated but ignored. Since partition a decade ago, they had overwhelmed parts of Taliganj the way monsoon rain obscured the lowland. Some of the government workers had received homes in the exchange program, but most were refugees arriving in waves, stripped of their ancestral land. A rapid trickle, then a flood. Subhash and Udayan remembered them, a grim procession, a human herd, a few bundles on their heads, infants strapped to parents' chests. They made shelters of canvas or thatch, walls of woven bamboo. They lived without sanitation, without electricity, in shanties next to garbage heaps, in any available space. They were the reason the Adi Ganga, on the banks of which the Tolly Club stood, was now a sewer canal for southwest Calcutta. They were the reason for the club's additional walls. Subhash and Udayan found no wire fencing. They stopped at a spot where the wall was low enough to scale. They were wearing shorts. Their pockets were stuffed with golf balls. Bismillah said they would find plenty more inside the club, where the balls lay on the ground alongside the pods that fell from tamarind trees. Udayan flung the putting iron over the wall, then one of the kerosene tins. Standing on the remaining tin would give Subhash enough leverage to make it over. But Udayan was a few inches shorter in those days. "Place your fingers," Udayan said. Subhash brought his hands together. He felt the weight of his brother's foot, the worn sole of his sandal, then his whole body bearing down for an instant. Quickly, Udayan hoisted himself up. He straddled the wall. "Should I stand guard on this side while you explore?" Subhash asked him. "What fun would that be? What do you see? Come, see for yourself." Subhash nudged the kerosene tin closer to the wall. He stepped onto it, feeling the hollow structure wobble beneath him. "Let's go, Subhash." Udayan readjusted himself, dropping down so that only his fingertips were visible. Then he released his hands and fell. Subhash could hear him breathing hard from the effort. "You're all right? Of course, now you." Subhash gripped the wall with his hands, hugging it to his chest, scraping his knees. As usual, he was uncertain whether he was more frustrated by Udayan's daring or with himself for his lack of it. Subhash was 13, older by 15 months, but he had no sense of himself without Udayan. From his earliest memories, at every point, his brother was there. Suddenly, they were no longer in Taliganj. They could hear the traffic continuing down the street, but could no longer see it. They were surrounded by massive cannonball trees and eucalyptus, bottle brush, and frangipani. Subhash had never seen such grass as uniform as a carpet, unfurled over sloping contours of earth, undulating like dunes in a desert or gentle dips and swells in a sea. It was shorn so finely on the putting green that it felt like moss when he pressed against it. The ground below was as smooth as a scalp, the grass appearing a shade lighter there. He had not seen so many egrets in one place, flying off when he came too close. The trees threw afternoon shadows on the lawn, their smooth limbs divided when he looked up at them like the forbidden zones of a woman's body. They were both giddy from the thrill of trespassing, from the fear of being caught. But no guard on foot or horseback, no groundsman spotted them. No one came to chase them away. They began to relax, discovering a series of flags planted along the course. The holes were like navels in the earth, fitted with cups, indicating where the golf balls were supposed to go. They were shallow pits of sand interspersed here and there, puddles on the fairway, strangely shaped, like droplets viewed under a microscope. They kept far from the main entrance, not venturing toward the clubhouse where foreign couples walked arm in arm or sat on cane chairs under the trees. From time to time, Bismillah had said there was a birthday party for the child of a British family still living in India, with ice cream and pony rides, a cake in which candles burned. Though Nehru was prime minister, it was the new Queen of England, Elizabeth II, whose portrait presided in the main drawing room. In their neglected corner, in the company of a water buffalo that had strayed in, Udayan swung forcefully, raising his arms over his head, assuming poses, brandishing the putting iron like a sword. He broke apart the pristine turf, losing a few golf balls in one of the bodies of water. They searched for replacements in the rough. Subhash was the lookout, listening for the approach of horses' hooves on the broad red dirt paths. He heard the taps of a woodpecker, the faint strikes of a sickle as a section of grass elsewhere in the club was trimmed by hand. Groups of jackals sat erect in packs, their tawny hides mottled with gray. As the light dwindled, a few began to search for food, their lean forms trotting in straight lines. Their distraught howling, echoing within the club, signaled that it was late, time for the brothers to go home. They left the two kerosene tins, the one on the outside to mark the place. They made sure to hide the one inside the club behind some shrubbery. On subsequent visits, Subhash collected feathers and wild almonds. He saw vultures bathing in puddles, spreading their wings to dry. Once he found an egg that had dropped intact from a warbler's nest. Carefully, he carried it home with him, placing it in a terracotta container from a sweet shop, covering it with twigs, digging a hole for it in the garden behind their house at the base of the mango tree when the egg did not hatch. Then one evening, throwing over the putting iron from inside the club, climbing back over the wall, they noticed that the kerosene tin on the other side was missing. Someone took it, Udayan said. He started to search. The light was scant. Is this what you boys are looking for? It was a policeman appearing from nowhere, patrolling the area around the club. They could distinguish his height, his uniform. He was holding the tin. He took a few steps toward them, spotting the putting iron on the ground. He picked it up, inspecting it. He set down the tin and switched on a flashlight, focusing its beam on each of their faces, then down the length of their bodies. Brothers, Subhash nodded. What's in your pockets? They removed the golf balls and surrendered them. They watched the policeman put them in his own pockets. He kept one out, tossing it into the air and catching it in his hand. How did you come to acquire these? They were silent. Someone invited you today to play golf at the club. They shook their heads. You don't need me to tell you that these grounds are restricted, the policeman said. He rested the shaft of the putting iron lightly against Subhash's arm. Was today your first visit? No. Was this your idea? Aren't you old enough to know better? It was my idea, Udayan said. You have a loyal brother, the policeman said to Subhash, wanting to protect you, willing to take the blame. I'll do you a favor this time, he continued. I won't mention it to the club, as long as you don't intend to try it again. We won't return, Subhash said. Very well. Shall I escort you home to your parents, or should we conclude our conversation here? Here. Turn around, then. Only you. Subhash faced the wall. Take another step. He felt the steel shaft striking his haunches, then the backs of his legs. The force of the second blow, only an instant of contact, brought him to his hands and knees. It would take some days for the welts to go down. Their parents had never beaten them. He felt nothing at first, only numbness, then a sensation that was like boiling water tossed from a pan against his skin. Stop it, Udayan shouted to the policeman. He crouched next to Subhash, throwing an arm across his shoulders, attempting to shield him. Together, pressed against one another, they braced themselves. Their heads were lowered, their eyes closed, Subhash still reeling from pain. But nothing more happened. They heard the sound of the putting iron being tossed over the wall, landing a final time inside the club. Then the policeman, who wanted nothing more to do with them, retreating. So that's the first, that's the end of this section. And then the boys, the brothers, grow up side by side in their neighborhood in Calcutta into the 1960s. They remained very close, but then they, at a certain point, they graduate from high school and they begin to go to different universities, both universities in Calcutta, but different universities. And this is the first moment in which they begin to diverge paths. In 1967, there is a Maoist uprising in West Bengal, which is both thwarted and begins to gain momentum and attracts a great number of students in Calcutta among its following. And Udayan, the younger brother, is very attracted to this movement and begins to secretly participate in it. Subhash remains skeptical of the movement and its methods and aims, and decides after their university years end to leave India, to leave Calcutta, and to come to America, to Rhode Island, to study oceanography. And so the brothers part at that point in their mid-20s, both literally but also in an emotional sense, there's a juncture. And so this next section that I'm going to read is begins with Subhash, again, from his point of view, begins with him arriving in Rhode Island. This will be 1969, so about 10 or 12 years after the scene I just read. And the movement I referred to is called Nakshalbari, which I refer to in this section. A few months later, Subhash also traveled to a village. This was the word the Americans used, an old-fashioned word designating an early settlement, a humble place. And yet the village had once contained a civilization, a church, a courthouse, a tavern, a jail. The university had begun as an agricultural school, a land-grant college still surrounded by greenhouses, orchards, fields of corn. On the outskirts were lush pastures of scientifically cultivated grass, routinely irrigated and fertilized and trimmed, nicer than the grass that grew inside the walls of the Tolly Club. But he was no longer in Tollygunj. He had stepped out of it, as he had stepped so many mornings out of dreams, its reality and its particular logic rendered meaningless in the light of day. The difference was so extreme that he could not accommodate the two places together in his mind. In this enormous new country, there seemed to be nowhere for the old to reside. There was nothing to link them. He was the sole link. Here life ceased to obstruct or assault him. Here was a place where humanity was not always pushing, rushing, running, as if with a fire at its back. And yet, certain physical aspects of Rhode Island, a state so small within the context of America that on some maps its landmass was indicated only by an arrow pointing to its location, corresponded roughly to those of Calcutta within India, mountains to the north and ocean to the east, the majority of land to the south and west. Both places were close to sea level, were estuaries where fresh and salt water with estuaries where fresh and salt water combined. As Tollygunj in a previous era had been flooded by sea, all of Rhode Island, he learned, had once been covered with sheets of ice. The advance and retreat of the glaciers, spreading and melting over New England, had shifted bedrock and soil, leaving great trails of debris. They had created marshes and the bay, dunes and moraines. They had shaped the current shore. He found a room in a white wooden house close to the main road of the village, with black shutters flanking the windows. The shutters were decorative, never opening or closing as they did throughout the day in Calcutta, to keep rooms cool or dry, to block rain or let in a breeze or adjust the light. He lived at the top of the house, sharing a kitchen and bathroom with another PhD student named Richard Grifalconi. At night, he heard the precise ticking of an alarm clock at the side of his bed, and in the background, like an ongoing alarm itself, the shrill thrum of crickets. New birds woke him in the morning, small birds with delicate chirps that ruptured sleep nevertheless. Richard, a student of sociology, wrote editorials for the university newspaper. When he wasn't working on his dissertation, he decried in terse paragraphs the recent firing of a zoology professor who had spoken out against the use of napalm or the decision to build a swimming pool instead of more dormitories on campus. He came from a Quaker family in Wisconsin. He wore his dark hair in a ponytail and didn't bother to trim his beard. He peered closely through wire-rimmed spectacles as he pecked out his editorials with two fingers at their kitchen table, a cigarette burning between his lips. He told Subhash that he'd just turned 30. For the sake of the next generation, he decided to become a professor. He traveled to the South as an undergraduate to protest segregation on public transportation. He'd spent 2 weeks in a Mississippi jail. He invited Subhash to go with him to the campus pub, where they shared a pitcher of beer and watched the television reports of Vietnam. Richard opposed the war, but he wasn't a communist. He told Subhash that Gandhi was a hero to him. Udayan would have scoffed, saying that Gandhi had sided with enemies of the people, that he had disarmed India in the name of liberation. One day, walking past the quadrangle, Subhash saw Richard at the center of a group of students and faculty. He was wearing a black armband, standing on top of a van that had been driven onto the grass. Speaking through a megaphone, Richard said Vietnam was a mistake and that the American government had had no right to intervene. He said innocent people in Vietnam were suffering. Some people called out or cheered, but most of them just listened and clapped as they might at the theater. They sprawled back on their elbows, sunning their faces, listening to Richard protest a war that was being fought thousands of miles away. Subhash was the only foreigner. No students from other parts of Asia were there. It was nothing like the demonstrations that erupted now in Calcutta. Disorganized mobs representing rival communist parties running helter-skelter through the streets, chanting, unrelenting. They were demonstrations that almost always turned violent. After listening to Richard for a few minutes, Subhash left. He knew how much Udayan would have mocked him at that moment for his desire to protect himself. He didn't support the war in Vietnam either, but like his father, he knew he had to be careful. He knew he could get arrested in America for denouncing the government, perhaps even for holding up a sign. He was here courtesy of a student visa, thanks to a fellowship. He'd been invited to America as Nixon's guest. Here each day he remembered how he'd felt those evenings he and Udayan had snuck into the Tali Club. This time he'd been admitted officially, and yet he remained vigilant at the threshold. He knew that the door could close just as arbitrarily as it had opened. He knew that he could be sent back to where he'd come from and that there would be plenty to take his place. There were a few other Indians at the university, mostly bachelors like him, but as far as Subhash could tell, he was the only one from Calcutta. He met an economics professor named Narasimhan from Madras. He had an American wife and two tanned, light-eyed sons who looked like neither of their parents. Narasimhan wore heavy sideburns, bell-bottom jeans. His wife had a pretty neck, long beaded earrings, short red hair. Subhash saw them all for the first time on the quadrangle. They were the only people that Saturday afternoon in the square green enclosure at the center of campus, rimmed with trees. The boys were kicking a ball on the grass with their father, as Subhash and Udayan used to do on the field on the other side of the lowland, though their father had never joined them. The wife was lying on a blanket on the grass on her side, smoking, sketching something in a notebook. This was the woman Narasimhan had married, as opposed to whatever girl from Madras his family had wanted for him. Subhash wondered how his family had reacted to her. He wondered if she'd ever been to India. If she had, he wondered whether she'd liked it or hated it. He could not guess from looking at her. The ball rolled over in Subhash's direction, and he kicked it back to them, preparing to continue on his way. "You must be the new student in marine chemistry," Narasimhan said, walking toward him, shaking his hand. "Subhash Mitra, yes, from Calcutta," he nodded. "I'm supposed to keep an eye out for you. I was born in Calcutta," Narasimhan added, saying that he still understood a word or two of Bengali. Subhash asked where in Rhode Island he lived, whether it was close to campus. Narasimhan shook his head. Their house was closer to Providence. His wife, Kate, was a student at the Rhode Island School of Design. "And you, where in Calcutta is your family?" "In Taliganj." "Ah, where the golf club is." "Yes." "You're staying at the International House." "I preferred a place with a kitchen. I wanted to make my own meals." "And you've settled in, made some friends?" "A few. Tolerating the cold, so far." "Kate, write down our phone number for him, will you?" She turned to the back of her notebook and tore out a page. She wrote down the number and handed it to Subhash. "Anything you need, just give a call," Narasimhan said, patting him on the shoulder, turning back to his sons. "Thank you." "I'll make you my yogurt rice one of these days," Narasimhan called out. But an invitation never came. The oceanography campus, where most of his classes were held, overlooked the Narragansett Bay. Every morning on a bus, he left the village behind, traveling along a wooden road where mailboxes stuck on posts were visible, but many of the homes were not. Past a set of traffic lights and a wooden observation tower, before proceeding downhill toward the bay. The bus crossed over a winding estuary to an area that felt more remote. Here the air was never still, so that the windows of the bus would rattle. Here the quality of the light changed. The laboratory buildings were like small airplane hangars, flat-top structures made of corrugated gray metal. He studied the gases that were dissolved in the sea's solution, the isotopes found in deep sediments, the iodine found in seaweed, the carbon in plankton, the copper in the blood of crabs. At the foot of the campus, at the base of a steep hill, there was a small beach strewn with gray and yellow stones where he liked to eat his lunch. There were views of the bay and the two bridges going to islands offshore. The Jamestown Bridge was prominent, the Newport Bridge a few miles in the distance more faint. On cloudy days at intervals, the sound of a foghorn pierced the air as conch shells were blown in Calcutta to ward off evil. Some of the smaller islands, reachable only by boat, were without electricity and running water, conditions under which, he was told, certain wealthy Americans liked to spend their summers. On one island, there was space only for a lighthouse, nothing more. All the islands, however tiny, had names: Patience and Prudence, Fox and Goat, Rabbit and Rose, Hope and Despair. At the top of the hill, leading up from the beach, there was a church with white shingles arranged like a honeycomb. The central portion rose to a steeple. The paint was no longer fresh. Beneath it, the wood beneath it having absorbed so much salt from the air, so many storms that had traveled up the Rhode Island coast. One afternoon, he was surprised to see cars lining the road where it crested. For the first time, he saw that the front doors of the church were open. A group of people, a mix of adults and children, no more than 20, stood outside. He glimpsed a couple in middle age, a woman in a pale blue jacket and skirt. They stood smiling on the steps of the church, ducking their heads as the group showered them with rice, looking like they should have been parents of the bride and groom, closer to his parents' generation than to his own. He guessed that it was a second marriage, two people trading one spouse for another, dividing in two their connections at once severed and doubled like cells. Or perhaps it was a case of a couple who had both lost their spouses in midlife, a widow and a widower with grown children, remarrying and moving on. For some reason, the church reminded him of the small mosque that stood at the corner of his family's neighborhood in Tollygunj, another place of worship designated for others, which had served as a landmark in his life. One day, when the church was empty, Subhash walked up the stone path to the entrance. He felt the strange urge to embrace it. The narrow proportions were so severe that it seemed scarcely wider than his arm span. The only entrance was the rounded dark green door at the front. Above it, the windows, also rounded, were as thin as slits, space for a hand to poke out, but not a face. The door was locked, so he walked around the building, standing on the balls of his feet and looking into the windows. Some of the panes were made of red glass interspersed with clear ones. Inside, he saw gray pews edged with red trim. It was an interior at once pristine and vibrant, bathed with light. He wanted to sit inside, to feel the pale walls around him, the simple, tightly angled ceiling overhead. He thought of the couple he'd seen getting married. He imagined them standing next to one another. For the first time, he thought of his own marriage. For the first time, perhaps because he always felt in Rhode Island that some part of him was missing, he desired a companion. He wondered what woman his parents would choose for him. He wondered when it would be. Getting married would mean returning to Calcutta. In that sense, he was in no hurry. He was proud to have come alone to America, to learn it as he once must have learned to stand and walk and speak. He'd wanted so much to leave Calcutta, not only for the sake of his education, but also, he could admit this to himself now, to take a step Udayan never would. In the end, this was what had motivated him, and yet the motivation had done nothing to prepare him. Each day, in spite of its growing routine, felt uncertain. improvisational. Here, in this place surrounded by sea, he was drifting far from his point of origin. Here, detached from Udayan, he was ignorant of so many things. Thank you.
Our interviewer, Daphne Calotti, is another pride of our program. In fact, we were not in the same year. I think she was a year behind Junpan and me. But I forgot to mention that both Junpan and Daphne earned their PhDs from our former university professors program. And so they are both scholars. Definitely, in fact, under the guidance of Sobello, and she wrote her dissertation on Mavis Gallant, the great Canadian short story writer who just passed away. And Definitely has published 3 books, a collection of short stories, Calamity and the Other Stories, and 2 novels, Russian Winter, that has been translated into several languages. And the last fall, her new novel, Sight Reading, came out. She has taught at several colleges. This fall, she's going to start at UMass Boston. Thank you, Daphne.
So thanks so much. Thanks for that introduction. And Junpa, thanks for reading. That's so beautiful. And I was struck once again by the opening in the Tolly Club, which is so vivid and visual, and then returns so painfully at the end of that chapter. It's the first act of violence in your book. And when I was reading the novel through, I realized it reemerges. I mean, even in the scene that we saw in Rhode Island, oh, the golf club's there. It becomes the place of Udayan's first act of rebellion. We see it as a vacation spot. And what I wondered as a writer when I was reading was, at what point did you realize, oh, this is a really great motif. This will really work metaphorically for the novel. Did it take a while to get to that point?
Well, I wasn't thinking about it consciously as having deeper repercussions or ramifications for the book, but it did occur to me over time as I was writing the book that the choice to open the book there it was something that would unfold over the course of the novel. The novel grew out of an incident that had taken place very close to the Tolly Club. My father grew up in Tolly Gunj, that neighborhood, and the novel grew out of something that happened in his neighborhood. And I, as a child, made many trips to Calcutta and to that neighborhood, and have many very vivid memories of riding in a taxi past the walls of the Tolly Club and going, arriving eventually to my father's neighborhood. And like my characters, I was, and like so many people, the vast majority of people who live in that neighborhood, it's quite an impressive compound, but it's walled off and very few people go in. You know, it's sort of like the Willy Wonka chocolate factory. But everybody knows it's there. You know, everyone sees it. Everyone lives with it day after day. And it was something that taught me as a child about class differences, among other things. My father's family did not come from a wealthy family. So, you know, my grandparents were not at all a part of that world. And even though we were coming from the United States, and people thought we were rich Americans because we were coming from America. But you know, I would observe the differences in the people who did seem to belong, or did belong, and the very the vast majority who didn't. I think one of the things that occurred to me after having written the book, I mean, as you say, the club and the motif of the club, it does become a motif in a way, because it remains a central moment in the book between the two brothers and what happens with Udayan. And then as the book unfolds, it makes various appearances. It has it has a few different roles, this club. But I think what was the biggest revelation for me after having written the book is how much this club was a metaphor, in a sense, for my whole life, because I felt that, and continues in some way to be a metaphor, because I feel like I've always been someone who has been on the outside of something, looking in and trying to get in, but knowing that I'm not really a part of it, and like the brothers, intrigued and wanting to find a way in, and the place that I'm trying to enter, it's sort of irrelevant. But I mean, obviously, when I was a child, that place was America, and I felt that though I lived there, though I lived here, I grew up here, I was not part of this culture, and I longed to be part of it, but I couldn't, and there was a wall. And then, you know, conversely, when I would visit India, which, as I said, I did frequently, I felt the opposite sensation. And then the world of Calcutta and my extended family and my cousins, and that sense of deep-rooted belonging was also sort of walled off to me. It's played out in many other ways in my life. I think that, thinking about being here at BU all of those years ago, I arrived as a student of literature, and at that point, the world inside of the walls was creative writing, was the world of writing fiction, and I was trying to get in there, but I worried that I didn't belong, you know. And in fact, it was Leslie who gave me a break, like a lenient guard or somebody, saying, okay, you can sneak in and sit in on a class. And it was an act of kindness that saved my life. And so, you know, that was another moment in which I felt that there was this tension always of wanting to belong to something, being attracted to something, and then an act of transgression that is involved in actually going into that world. And now I live in Rome, in another country, and so now Italy has become that place. So it's a very rich metaphor for me personally, as a, you know, just as a human being, and also as a writer. But I think that in a way it's a sort of perfect metaphor for any writer, because that is exactly where you want to be. You don't want to be in there, but you want a sort of secret access. And I was very gratified in a way. I mean, we as writers, we shouldn't go looking for motifs and things, but sometimes they do present themselves, and this one did.
Can you tell us, you know, something else that I'm remembering is we took Italian here together at BU many years ago as part of our language requirement. And even then, you had an affinity for the culture. And I don't know if you were planning that at one point you would go there, but I realized you're a close friend, and I don't really know what it is that drew you to Italy, of all places. It's a small, pretty homogenous country. And you have just had such a wonderful response that you've really sort of fallen in love with it, living there. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us how you feel about that country.
Well, what attracted me first is what continues in some sense to attract me the most, and that is the language. I went to Italy for the first time in my life when I was a student at BU. I spent a week in Florence with my sister looking at things. But what I came back with above everything else was the sound of the language, which had entered me in some way. And I felt the need to learn the language, and so I started with you in that class. And little by little, it turned into a sort of vocation. And I spent almost 20 years in America learning a foreign language from afar, which was a very strange experience, but enabled me, when I arrived in Italy to live, to have some basic competency, fluency. I could talk, I could make friends, I could, and that was amazing to be able to arrive there and to make those kinds of connections with people. And so over time, it's just, grown. I also, before I left America, I stopped reading in English about 6 months before I left. So about for 2 years now, I haven't really read anything in English. This afternoon, at Daphne's house, I was reading a few pages of a Mavis Gallant story. Mavis Gallant, I owe Mavis Gallant everything, but I owe my discovery of Mavis Gallant to Daphne. And so it's very odd, we were talking about this earlier, it's very odd, very unsettling, but also very beautiful that I should be here tonight talking to Daphne on stage, staying with her, and, Mavis has just died, and we spent part of the day writing a small, I was asked to write a small piece for her for the New Yorker magazine, which was her home. Mm-hmm. So I was reading a few pages of her, one of her stories, and I realized to me now, reading English, it sounds absurd, but it has a different quality, and it's almost as if I'm reading a foreign language, but I know it really well, because I've been detached from it for so long, and I'm not a reader in it at the moment. I don't know how long this particular phase will last in my life, but right now it's going strong, and I feel like it's what I need, and it's what's feeding me, and it feels like an enormous just change, sea change, and an opening up of a whole new world. So it's the language for me that, I love many things about Italy in spite of its homogenous provincial qualities. And I feel very at home there, even though it's not my home. And again, this goes back to Mavis, of course, who chose to live her life in Paris. I think the difference between Mavis and myself is that she, as you pointed out earlier, always considered herself Canadian and called herself a Canadian expatriate in Paris and always wrote in English, even though she spoke flawless French, and read in it. Whereas I feel I have a much more slippery hold on who I am and what my identity is. And so I don't feel like an American in Italy. I don't feel like anything in particular anywhere. But being there is, it's giving me back a sort of place that I need to be, I think, creatively, the place I feel most comfortable is the place where I'm not comfortable, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And I think the impulse to move away for a while, to leave everything, to leave even my language, my dominant language, because English is not my mother tongue, but to leave everything that has sort of formed me and shaped me, including, you know, people like Mavis, whose work I was just so hungry for, and then to stop reading her, I think it takes me back to that place where now I'm in an entirely new environment, an entirely new set of coordinates, and I'm back at that place where I'm not inside of there. Mm-hmm. And I think that what happened over time is that there was a moment in Brooklyn, where we live normally, where I suddenly felt I was no longer on the outside of the walls, but I was on the inside, and it scared me. Mm-hmm. And I felt that, gosh, I've been working my whole life to get in here, and now I'm here, and all I want to do is get out. And I feel, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I listened to that impulse. I think it was important for me. Mm-hmm. But it is odd. But I think it goes back to, it's where I need to be to write, to create. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not in that place, I don't feel the urgency in the same way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, we're so grateful that you came back briefly behind the wall to join us. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
thank you all.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program. Our speaker was Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri. Moderating tonight's conversation was award-winning author Daphne Colote. We began with an introduction by Boston University professor Ha Jin from the Creative Writing Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Laidotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.